Mike Massimino is not only a real astronaut, he's also played one on television. He flew on 2 shuttle missions to repair the Hubble Space Telescope while logging over 30 hours of spacewalking, but perhaps he's most recognizable to the general public for appearing on The Big Bang Theory and for being the first person to tweet from space. His new memoir, Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe, describes his path to space and what the job was like. It is published by Crown Archetype. I spoke with him in October, and we are replaying that interview for you now. I began by asking him, so have you unlocked the secrets of the universe?
No, we're still trying to do that with Hubble and other things we're doing in the space program. But it's when I was, I'm an engineer, so we would get, because I went to Hubble, I would often get questions about astronomy. And I know a little bit about astronomy. I like it very much. But after a while, people would ask me, what about this and what about that? And what does Hubble do? And I would say, just generally, I would say, it unlocks the secrets of the universe. So that's how we got,
and how
we got
are we doing?
That part of it. We're doing okay. I mean, we're getting there. We've answered a lot of questions. We keep finding out more information. You know, what Hubble did, for example, was come up with there's been one Nobel Prize so far awarded from Hubble data, and that was the discovery of dark energy. And that is something we couldn't even fathom that existed. We didn't even know to ask that question. I mean, there were some scientists looking at trying to quantify the expansion rate of the universe, because we had the Big Bang Theory, not the TV show, but the theory itself.
We had Arno Penzias as a guest on this show.
There you go. So we had they were trying to come up with the rate of expansion, and what they found out that it wasn't slowing down, it was actually speeding up, and that's how we got dark energy. So I think what's happening is we're getting some answers to questions, but we're also getting new questions to ask. And we're getting closer and closer to the truth, whatever that means, of what those secrets are, and understanding, you know, where we came from, who we are, how did we get here, and what happens afterwards, and so on. And I think that's through devices like the Hubble Space Telescope that we get there.
But you write that Hubble isn't the first thing people ask you about. It's that whether you were scared going to space. What do you tell them?
Yeah, I tell them yes. And the truth is yes. Particularly looking at the spaceship before my first launch, and the realization that this is, no kidding, happening. It's not just an idea or a dream. And I would say it, even though I was selected as an astronaut and trained for years and got ready and was prepared, there was still nothing like actually going out there that morning. It was early morning, in the middle of the night, for my first launch, and seeing that. And you realize that, you know, this is, out of all the days you live in life, this is probably the one most likely that it's going to be over. You know, so
because we have seen tragedies in the past.
That's
this
right.
This is a very there are all sorts of unknowns.
Yes,
still about space travel.
That's right. It's a dangerous business, and it's just the nature of it, and it's going to be that way for some time.
Were you one of those kids who said, I want to grow up to be an astronaut?
I was. I was when
but
I was.
But also a pro baseball player.
Yes.
The two don't work together.
Not necessarily. No. We
unless you work for the Astros.
That's right. Then the closest I came was throwing out a pitch at Shea Stadium. So, I love baseball. It's still my passion. Baseball and space are my two passions, certainly. But when I was, I can remember as a 6-year-old watching Neil Armstrong take those first steps on the moon. And that's what got me hooked, and that never left me. Growing up in Long Island, it never seemed like a real option to become an astronaut. And so I kind of forgot about it, and then my dream was rekindled after college, really. I got my dream rekindled and then decided to give it a try.
But you took an engineering job at IBM.
I did, yeah. I got out of, I really wasn't thinking about being an astronaut. I just never considered it. It seemed like it was crazy. How did you become an astronaut? It's impossible. You know, I didn't see any astronauts walking around, and I idolized Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and those guys, and then the shuttle program came along and kind of opened it up where there was people more relatable. It was more than just military test pilots, people, all types of people, but still never considered it as something I could actually do, and then realized that, yeah, it's probably that. I probably can't do it, but when I was in my early 20s working at IBM, I decided that it might not happen, but it certainly wasn't going to happen unless I tried, and I wanted to try.
And you were initially rejected by NASA.
Yes, I was initially rejected, and then again rejected, and then again rejected. I was rejected 3 times, and I was picked up on my 4th try.
Do you know why?
I think it was just that why I was picked or why I was rejected.
No, because I...
Because why I was picked is more of a mystery than why I was rejected. I mean, it makes sense that I would get rejected because there's so many thousands of people applying. And the first two times I just got a letter back. The third time I got interviewed by NASA, and this is going on after a couple of years. I think it's just there's so many thousands of people that apply and so few that can be picked.
But you have excellent qualifications, mm-hmm. including a PhD from MIT.
Yeah.
I would have thought that would have put you near the top of the
list. Well, it kind of gets you a look, I guess. But what happens in the interview, after I applied my third time, I got an interview. And then they get to know you really well, Leonard. You know, they want to get to, you know, you're there for a week and a lot of medical exams. And you know, they really want to know who you are. And after they got to know me really well, then they rejected me. So it was that's just the way it is. But I wasn't going to give up, so I applied the fourth time, and I got another interview, and that time I got picked.
I'm speaking with Mike Massimino, who served as a NASA astronaut from 1996 to 2014. He's written a memoir called Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. It is published by Crown Archetype. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. As part of your physical, mental, and psychological training... or screening,
mm-hmm.
They zipped you in a dark canvas bag. That might have ended my career right then and there.
Well, that was easy for me because I just had to crawl up and take a nap. Yeah, that was, they called it a personal rescue sphere. And they put a heart monitor on us and they had us sitting there for a while and, this little sphere to see how you did. And that was probably the easiest thing because I was just able to relax and take a nap. Some of the other stuff was a little more challenging.
You had to train your eyes to pass the vision test?
Yeah, that
How
was
you
the
train
other
thing. Your eyes?
Well, I wasn't left with many options. The vision standards have changed, but progress always comes too late. Now they accept things like LASIK and I don't know what other procedures, but I know they at least they accept that. If you're stable with that, you can improve your vision that way. But they didn't have that back then. It was still kind of old school. It was 20 years ago, over 20 years ago. And I was not able to – I couldn't see well enough to pass the eye exam. And they did not accept any procedure at that time to change eyesight. It just was too new.
And you couldn't wear contacts?
You could wear contacts, but they wanted your uncorrected vision to be within a certain limit. And I was beyond that. I just I was nearsighted beyond what their limit was for uncorrected vision. And so – so I was faced with this fact that I just wasn't medically qualified to participate. And I said, well, this is kind of an unacceptable outcome. I think I could have – I was okay if they would have told me, well, we didn't want you because we have thousands of other people that are better. And it's – you know, in some ways, you know, I expected that. But to say that they couldn't even consider me any longer – I didn't like that. And I figured, what else was I going to do? I could just, you know, give up, which I didn't want to do. I could keep trying. It was nothing to lose, but
well, how do
trying.
You train your eyes?
Well, I looked into it a little bit, you know, and there was something called vision training. And, there was not all the optometrists, believe in it really, but there are some that do. And,
obviously you do.
And I didn't have any choice, so I had to try something. And I met with, one of these optometrists down in Houston, and they said they thought they work a lot with children, so you know they were able to. It works better with younger people, is what I was told, that they can help them avoid wearing glasses. And now you know glasses aren't usually a problem, contacts aren't a problem. And this is not. It usually was for whatever reason, if someone wanted to improve their vision without using glasses. So they gave me a bunch of exercises. And what you try to do is relax your eye muscles so you're like seeing beyond the eye chart in some ways. And then the letters of the eye chart will come into focus. Mm-hmm. But it's a technique that is acquired, a skill that's acquired over a period of time. But it worked.
You were psychologically screened, and you say that very few jerks have been to space.
Yeah. I think what I've found is overall the quality of people that we have there is just outstanding, and I'm almost cringe to put myself in that category of individual because they're just great people. From not only in their ability to get things done and to achieve things, but really in the quality of their character, just wonderful people.
You can't do this kinds of things you do that is so complicated and still have to worry about somebody acting like a fool.
Right.
You know,
and yes,
rubbing you the wrong way.
Right. And it's a team game. And what, you know, you mentioned me earlier, you know, why did I get rejected those first couple of times? It's hard to quantify that element of it. You know, you said, yeah, MIT, PhD, yeah. Okay, a lot of people have that, or PhDs from other places or other accomplishments. But what you're really looking for is, what kind of person is this? Is this a person I can trust? Is this a person I would want to fly in space with? Is this a person I would trust my family with while I'm gone? And those are the types of things that don't come out by looking at your resume.
So you never had any fights with anybody?
Okay, so I would describe no fist fights, but I would describe a space shuttle crew or a space crew or even the astronaut program as a family. So if you think of a family, you sometimes have disagreements. You know, you love each other, right? Hopefully. And in this case, we did. You love each other. You'll stick by each other. You'll back each other up. You're in it together. But every once in a while, you disagree about something. So, yeah, certainly there's disagreements.
How many women were in the class?
Because
it was the largest class.
We had 35 Americans, 9 internationals. I think we might have had about nine women in that class. Now, the most recent class was 50-50. The most recent class of astronauts, there was 8 astronauts selected. And when did they show up? 2013, I think. And there was 4 men and 4 women in that class.
You were brought in as a mission specialist, not as a pilot.
Well, yes.
But you did have to know how to fly?
No. So I came in as a civilian mission specialist. So there was the flying part of it. Back in the shuttle days, we had 2 categories. Now it's more or less 1 category because we're not flying the space shuttle anymore. But back in the shuttle days, you certainly needed professionally trained, military trained test pilots to fly the space shuttle. The best pilots you could get. And so we had the pilot category. You had the mission specialist category. Now everybody's sort of mixed together. But certainly, being a test pilot, a military test pilot, is a path to being an astronaut. But so is a civilian career. And if you look at just the people I've flown with in space, the careers we had, the non-military people, I've flown with an oceanographer, Megan MacArthur. I've flown with astrophysicists and engineers, which is, you think, more traditional. But Megan was an oceanographer. Drew Feustel was a geologist, and not a planetary geologist, but, you know, looking for rocks in oil fields and so on. He's an oil field geologist before he became an astronaut. And Rick Linehan was a veterinarian, mm-hmm. a large animal vet. He liked dolphins. He was delivering a baby dolphin when he found out he was going to be an astronaut, and he told him to hold the call. He was busy delivering a dolphin. So you might say, well, how does that lead to being an astronaut? And it's just for the NASA program, any career or interest that is more or less math, STEM related, medicine, you name it, you can look online. That's a career that's qualifying.
Didn't you need to get a scuba certification?
I did. So I was scuba certified before I came to NASA, but I really wasn't a very strong swimmer. And one of the things that surprised me when I got to NASA was that I had to pass a swim test. One of the first things we did. It was funny. At Columbia, I was an undergraduate at Columbia, we had a swim test as well that we had to pass. But that was relatively easy. It was a couple laps of the pool. This was a little bit more intense, so I had to practice my swimming.
Does that help you prepare for going outside the spaceship?
The reason we needed to get scuba qualified was a couple things. We had to become good enough swimmers to pass water survival. One of the first things we got to do, which was incredible, was fly in T-38 jets. As a civilian without any – I did have a private license. Wasn't required. You asked me about that earlier. But I did have a private pilot license when I came to NASA, and I did have a scuba qualification. But those weren't requirements. They're just things I was interested in. Those are some of my hobbies. But when I got to NASA, the swim part of it was to prepare us to fly in an ejection seat aircraft, and these high-performance aircraft, T-38s. If you were to have an in-flight incident and needed to eject from the aircraft and you happened to eject over water, you needed to be able to parachute into the water and survive long enough for help to come get you. And so that was why we needed to swim for that. But also our training for spacewalking, we do that in an enormous pool at the Johnson Space Center. And in order to go through that training, you need to have a scuba qualification. And not only a scuba qualification, but you needed to pass their checkout in the water. You needed to pass NASA's scuba checkout. And no matter who you were, you had to pass that checkout. Jacques Cousteau actually came years ago to NASA, and they made him go through their checkout before he could scuba dive.
And you had to walk around a swimming pool because that prepares you for being out in space?
Yeah, you had to walk around a swimming pool, and you had to spacewalk in the pool. So if if you've ever been in the water, right, and you float in the water when you get, when you go there, and but also you also sink in the water, right? Things sink, rocks will sink, and anchors sink.
Oh, I sink faster than many.
There you go. Okay, so I have a strange property. I sink when I want to float, and I float when I want to sink. It just doesn't work for me. I'm like, it doesn't work with the water for me. But there is, when you're in a spacesuit, you know, there's going to be weight to it that's going to make you sink, and there's also buoyancy from the water. And so it also pushes you up. And those two forces, when they're neutral, when one cancels out the other, you're sort of floating in the water column like you are in space. So we get a way out from our diver helpers with weights and with flotation so that when you're practicing your spacewalks, a very deep pool, it's 40 feet deep, it's 100 feet wide, and it's 200 feet long. It's the biggest pool in the world. When you're inside there underneath the water working on a mock-up of the space station, or in my case, the Hubble Space Telescope, you're weighed out so that you're neutrally buoyant and you're floating in the water and working on your task similar to like you would be doing in space.
Aren't you 6'3"? Is being tall an advantage for walking in space?
It is. It certainly is. It allows you to manipulate the suit a little bit easier. It doesn't mean if you're smaller that you can't do it. There are smaller people that are excellent spacewalkers, much better than I am. But you have a natural advantage if you're a little bit taller. You can reach things, for example. You don't have to move around as much in order to reach things. You can get your hands and your arms into places that other people can't, and you can move that suit and manipulate it much easier. But that doesn't mean if you're a smaller person you can't do it. You just have to be a little more clever about it.
I'm speaking with Mike Massimino, who's written a memoir called Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. It's published by Crown Archetype, and we will continue a conversation after this. We're back with a rebroadcast of my interview this past October with Mike Massimino. He's written a memoir called Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe, and it's published by Crown Archetype. I continued the conversation by asking him, what kinds of things are visible only to telescopes in space?
Well, the atmosphere distorts the light coming into our planet. So, for example, if you look at the sun, if you go into a swimming pool and you look up through the water at the sun, you're going to see a very blurry sun. And when you get out of the water and you look directly in the sun, you see it much, much clearer. And that's sort of the effect that the atmosphere has when we look at stars.
But Hubble, of course, was blurry when it was first launched in 1990 because people screwed up.
That was a different reason, yeah.
What happened?
So being above the atmosphere should give you
inches and meters in preparing it?
I think what they ended up with was that the primary mirror, the mirror on the telescope, was ground with a very small imperfection. The imperfection it was smaller than the width of a human hair. So we're not talking about a big amount of imperfection, but it certainly was a big mistake because it could not see very clearly. And it was what it was actually is that the machine that calibrated the machine that ground the mirror was off. So they thought they were grinding it perfectly, but it was the calibration machine was off and screwed it up.
So it had to be fixed with a spacewalk.
It had to be
That's
fixed
not
with
your
a
spacewalk.
No, that was on the very first servicing mission. Back in 1993, the telescope was launched in 1990. They turned it on and they found they couldn't see very well with it. And what they did is they gave it glasses. They literally gave the telescope glasses. They sacrificed an instrument. So the Hubble has a bunch of science instruments on it, and they have four of these instruments are what we call axial instruments, which are about the size of a refrigerator or a telephone booth. And they fit into the telescope in different sections. And they removed one of those science instruments to put a corrective optics instrument called COSTAR, Corrective Optics Space Telescope Axial Replacement. And what that did, it got in that position, and then it had access to the light path. It threw a bunch of mirrors into the light path that corrected the aberration of the ground mirror, the imperfection. It corrected that, just like glasses correct the light coming into our eyes. That's all it did. If you're nearsighted or farsighted, the light does not focus correctly back on your retina. You put glasses on, the light then gets redirected and hits your eyeball exactly like it should. And that's what they did with the correction on the first servicing mission.
And now the Hubble's camera can produce extremely high-resolution images.
Yes.
they look gorgeous.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It shows the wonder of what's out there, and I think to me that's one of the wonderful things about it, is that everyone can enjoy looking at these photos, at these images. Scientists can analyze them and learn about our universe and share that with us, but everyone can take a look at those beautiful images and wonder what's out there.
I'd imagine that when NASA proposed the Hubble, they had no idea that it was going to play such an important role in science.
No.
The discovery, well, nobody knew that there was dark matter.
No, and dark matter, dark energy, black holes, that their existence, planets and other solar systems. These are all things that we weren't able to truly see from ground-based telescopes, and now Hubble opened that up to us. And I think that's the mark of a great scientific instrument. It not only answers questions you're looking for, but opens up things you couldn't even dream of when you developed it.
The stars that we see from space are of all different colors. Why don't we see those colors on Earth?
It's a function of our atmosphere filtering that color out. When you get above that atmosphere and you see them directly, even with the naked eye from a spaceship, you can see some of those colors. It's amazing how the Twinkle Twinkle Little Star song was written by someone on Earth, because the stars do not twinkle when you get above the atmosphere. They're perfect points of light.
What about sunlight? Does it appear differently?
Yeah, it's amazing, Leonard. It really became evident to me during my first spacewalk. The sunlight is filtered through our atmosphere on Earth, and even when you're in space, it is filtered in some extent by the windows. It's very much brighter, but it's still filtered somewhat by the windows of the spacecraft. But when you get outside and just have your visor between you and what's out there, it is the brightest white I've ever experienced. It's beyond. I felt like it wasn't even like light. I felt like it was purity, and I felt like I was seeing colors. Even the colors like the American flag on my shoulder or anything that around the payload bay, everything looks so crisp and clear because of that white light. It's just like pure purity of light. And the sun looks like a big star out in the distance. And you can see it shining on the Earth. You know, you can look at this, you know, the sun on your right, and then turn your head and you see what it's doing, lighting up the Earth on your left, for example. It's incredible.
The Hubble orbits around the Earth every 97 minutes, so do you see sunrises and sunsets?
You go through, yeah. So at that rate, you get about 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets in a 24-hour period.
And what happens when it gets dark? When it gets dark on Earth, it gets cold. Does it get cold up there as well?
It does. And the darkness, as I described the light, as a pure white, pure whiteness, just a pure light. When you go to darkness, it's the exact opposite of that. I felt like it was the whole 180 degrees the other way, complete blackness. It was the void of light, no light, and not at all.
And when you're out there,
well, you do have helmet lights to help you. You have lights around the payload bay. There are some that helps you a little bit, but basically you're in the dark.
And your spacesuit, I assume, protects you from the temperature extremes.
Yes, there's huge temperature changes. If you have a thermometer away from the spacecraft, you can get a couple hundred degrees in each direction, a couple hundred degrees above Fahrenheit in the sun, a couple hundred degrees below Fahrenheit, below zero, a couple hundred degrees above zero in the sun, a couple hundred degrees below zero in the darkness. You don't feel that as much because you're around the space shuttle, which kind of has a moderating effect. And then also your spacesuit keeps you protected. But you do feel the temperature change. You can feel it coming. You can feel the sunrise or the sunset coming before you see it, and it's this feeling down in your bones, almost like if you're in the ocean and you feel a current of water, you know, you feel like kind of that cold current hit you. That's what it, like, you feel it down your bones, and sure enough, you can look, and then you see, here we go, we're coming. I can see the darkness coming, and then you can see the line from a spacewalk. I was able to see this. You can see the sun in the distance, and then you can see the line that separates night and day, and you're going, say, from daylight into the blackness, and you see that line moving as our Earth rotating. And it dawned on me that, you know, our teachers in first grade didn't lie to us, Leonard. They told us the truth, and that the Earth does revolve around the sun, and it does, you know, it spin. It orbits and it rotates, and you see that with your own eyes when you're in space, and it's this revelation. You know intellectually that that's what happens, but you see that play out, this cosmic dance play out in front of you, and the steadiness of the rotation, the steadiness of the march of that line that separates night and day as the sun is rising on a different part of the country or different part of the world, I got the sense of this has been going on for a very long time and is going to continue to go
on. We can only hope.
Way after, I think it will. I don't know who's going to be around, but I think that this sort of play is going to act out for a long time.
Mike Massimino's memoir, Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. How many astronauts were with you on your first trip up there?
Six others. We were a crew of seven on both of my missions. We were seven.
And then how soon before you start feeling weightless, and how do you adjust to weightlessness?
As soon as the engines cut, you have an 8.5-minute launch, and the main engines cut right at 8.5 minutes, and then there's this kind of silence. You do hear the whirring of equipment fans in the cabin of the space shuttle, of the spacecraft that you're in. But you're floating pretty much immediately. You're strapped down in your seat, but you can just feel things. You can kind of feel your arms get light. Everything gets light. You can see your pen float. You just see everything. There's like this ease to it. And it's just, okay, now the engines have cut. That part of it's over, and now we're just floating. And you can unstrap and float. And I took my helmet off and floated in front of me like Tom Hanks did in the movie Apollo 13. I imitated him, and then I took off my right glove and floated it in front of me. And I took my left glove and floated that in front of me, and then I looked back and couldn't find my right glove anymore because it floated away. But everything starts to float, including you.
And you, they had to actually come up with a pillow that wouldn't float away.
That's right. Yes, we're so used to having our head. Really, it's your head that's going to float off the pillow because your body position is kind of a natural sort of lurching forward when you're in space.
You were on the last.
You have a pillow that's more or less attached to your head that you can wear it and makes you feel better.
Is it hard to fall asleep?
No, not at all.
You were on the last servicing mission to the Hubble. Mm-hmm. What will happen if something new goes wrong now?
We're pretty much out of luck. I think that knowing the people at NASA and particularly the people in the Hubble team at the Goddard Space Flight Center and those that work on it at the Johnson Space Center, but knowing who those people are and how ingenious they are, if something were to go wrong, they could probably devise something to go up there and fix it. Our problem is we don't have a spaceship that can go there any longer. The Hubble was designed to be serviced by the space shuttle, and right now we don't have a way to get to it. So if anything went wrong with Hubble that would turn it off or stop it from producing its science, we're out of luck, at least for a little while. But I would think we would try to keep it alive until we could do something. But it really is unlikely. It's very unlikely we'll be able to service it again.
Now, most people think of the potential dangers of the launch, mm-hmm. but can't reentry be a real problem?
Well, certainly, yeah. Yeah, Columbia, the space shuttle Columbia, we lost on entry. And before I became an astronaut, we lost space shuttle Challenger during launch. And then after I was an astronaut, my first mission was on Columbia. And the mission right after I was on Columbia was STS-107. And that's when we lost Columbia on entry. So certainly, looking up for me, the most, I guess, terrifying or scary part of it was the launch. But certainly, entry has shown that can be deadly as well.
Did you see the movie Gravity?
I did, yes.
It's my sense that that's impossible.
It is impossible. Yeah, I mean, to go from place to place? No, absolutely impossible. You cannot go from orbit. They started out at Hubble, and they changed their inclination. Hubble's in a different inclination. You can change your altitude in your orbits. But changing your inclination to go from Hubble to the space station is impossible. But I still like the movie.
What about being in Big Bang Theory? Did they think you might just be a natural actor?
Sometimes you just step into things, right? You never know what's going to happen in life. But what happened there was the producers of the show, Chuck Lorre and Steve Molaro and Bill Prady, were interested in putting one of the characters into space. And they contacted NASA and asked if they could speak to an astronaut. And I got the phone call from NASA headquarters to, if I was ever out in L.A., to go speak to these guys. And I did. And I got to know the writers and the producers, speaking with them and giving some advice on a script after a couple hours. And then about 6 months later, I got a note from Bill Prady, said, would you like to come in and do a cameo? And that led to a few more, and I've been on the show 6 times. So it was just total luck that I had a chance to do that.
And you and your TV cast were in a Russian Soyuz capsule flying to the International Space Station.
Yep.
Were you impressed by just how much attention to detail they had?
Unbelievable. They were able to recreate the space station and the Soyuz, even my office. Because when I Skype on the show as if I'm in my office at NASA, but they had me come to the studios, to Warner Brothers Studios, to do that. And they rebuilt my office based on a photo I sent them. Their detail was amazing. The spacesuits, even that we were in a Russian Soyuz mock-up, and they even had some of the equipment were parts with Russian Cyrillic on it. Just amazing. And they were able to do this quickly.
Now, you
amazing.
You tweeted also from space. Is
I
that
did.
More complicated than tweeting in your home?
At that time, when I sent the first tweet from space.
What did you write?
And I wrote, launch was awesome. I'm feeling great. Enjoying the views or something like this. And
nothing political.
And the adventure of a lifetime has begun is what I wrote. I got made fun of on Saturday Night Live, which they made fun of my tweet by saying, you know, launch was awesome. We've gone 40 years from one small step for man, one giant leap from mankind to launch was awesome. But back then what I did is I had to put it in the form of an email. The email got sent down to Earth. And then it got put out as a tweet. Now they have a more direct connection to the internet.
The book is called Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. It's published by Crown Archetype. And what do you say in 10 seconds to people who say the space program is over?
No, it's never going to be. As long as there's people looking up and walking around the planet, we're going to want to go and explore. And so... No, it's not at all. We're still doing stuff. I'm very excited about the future.